accession number 9434, reel 12.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 12. I'd like now to go on beyond this period. Well, where did you go in March 1916 when you left the Loose sector?
Well, we went back to our place well behind the lines, where all the whole of the cavalry brigade was billeted, you see, out of the way of the traffic for the line itself. And what we did was to start a bit of training for what the big battle which was to come, that was the Somme, which opened on the 1st of July 1916. Well, you see, it was only April, May, June, July. It was only 3 months away. That great battle of the Somme was only 3 months away, and we were in training for that.
Was this back to Montichaux then?
Back to Montichaux, yes. The same place we went back to, and we started training, and at this time...
What sort of training was that?
Well, the training was... We formed a mounted section. As you see, there was always hopes and expectations on the part of our high command that they would be a breakthrough in the German line. And we started training a small section called the mounted pack section. Now, this was a section of three horses. One horse had special saddlebags over the saddle, with a saddlebag each side, full with dressings and iodine and all that sort of thing, medicines. And I was chosen, because I was a fairly good horseman, I was chosen to lead that section. There were the other two men were on horses, which carried a specially constructed stretcher on each side, you see, like a pack horse, but with sufficient room for them to ride to get their legs down. Now, this stretcher was invented by the 9th Cavalry Field Ambulance, Captain R.H. Price, and it was called the Price Stretcher. And I went to a demonstration of it by Regimental Sergeant Major Robinson. That was the dry Robinson that I mentioned of the two Robinsons before. He went to France as Regimental Sergeant Major of Number 9 Cavalry Field Ambulance. And he and Captain Price devised this stretcher, called the Price Stretcher, which could be carried on the side of a horse, like a pack horse. So there we were with a small section, and a medical officer who could follow the cavalry if and when they broke through the German lines and went at a rate through open country, but sustaining casualties, you see. The idea was not to have to leave those casualties to be treated by the slow-moving field ambulance which followed, you see, but to have some treatment on the spot where they happened.
This Price stretcher... Presumably, you could carry it. Would it carry one or two?
Only one. Only one man. It was a pole, almost like a what are the, you know, these things that they've seen a man carrying a woman inside a box on a stretcher, and they slotted in. They were in two nicely broken down, so that the two ends of the side of the stretcher slotted in and could be carried on the horse about 2 feet long. You see, 2 feet six, 3 feet long, and it was a very ingenious arrangement. There was canvas was there, and
would the horse carry one or two of these?
No, only one each side. That's all.
And then when you got to the where it was supposed to be used, it would be taken off and made up, and then it would be used as a normal stretcher.
Oh yes, used as a normal stretcher. They were taken down, fitted together, and there you had a stretcher quickly. It was quite an ingenious idea, and I went to the demonstration of it, and I thought it was an excellent idea.
So you trained in the use of this stretcher and of your unit, mounted?
I trained in the use of this thing while the in the intervening period between the Loos trenches and the Somme. Opening of the Somme.
Was there any battlefield simulation or tactical exercises involving the use of this new unit?
No. It really wasn't necessary because we knew exactly what we had to do. You see, you get the man dressed and on the stretcher, and that is all. That is all there is to it.
But did you train with the actual cavalry units at all? The art of keeping up with them of that.
Oh
sort?
No, we could keep up with them all right. You see, we were mounted on horses similar to every cavalry horse.
So there weren't any manoeuvres or
none at all. No.
Were there any other aspects of the preparations for the Somme that you remember?
No, we went up. Of course. It was unknown whether there would. Well, everyone hoped for a breakthrough. It was quite unknown whether there would be one or not. You see, the hopes were that it would happen, but as history tells us now, there was never any possibility of it happening.
So, after your training, were the cavalry moved up your brigade for the day of the Somme?
Yes, we were moved right up to Carnot, right up to the just behind the line. But of course, you know, the attack broke down badly at Beaumont Hamel, and to the north, the northern end of the Somme attack failed to make any ground. It was only the southern end that made an advance, and it soon became apparent that there wouldn't be any cavalry breakthrough, and so we moved back again.
Did you go right back to?
Went back to Montechaux.
So how much longer did you stay there? Were you disappointed, actually?
I was disappointed. I think they were disappointed. Well, we went back there, but we weren't there very long because we moved up again for the September attack when the tanks went in. We moved up for that. That was our next move up to the Somme.
Right. You want to take me through that?
Yes.
What had you heard about tanks beforehand?
Nothing at all. Never even knew they existed.
Right. If you take me through as you moved into the area then, were you being used as infantry or cavalry when you were brought up this time?
No, we went up as cavalry. And we went on the road from Montechaux, and on the morning of the 15th of September, for this particular attack, we had discarded the mounted pack section and left that with the transport, and we went up as foot stretcher bearers, you see, we started at 7 o'clock in the morning. We were reveille at 5, we were up and ready, and we started at 7, and we marched 20 miles to Carnoy. Now Carnoy was the place where the Somme battle started. That was the front line on the 1st of July. And we marched 20 miles to Carnoy and rested till about 2 o'clock down in the Carnoy Valley, which was getting towards the front line. Not the front line, but getting towards the approach to the front line, you see.
This is... When you say you marched, that means you left the horses behind.
Oh, yes,
the whole. Were you now again? Were they in composite battalions again?
No. We just all the stretcher bearers of Number 1 Cavalry Field Ambulance were formed. We formed them up into column of fours, and we marched the 20 miles ahead of the transport to ease the horses. You see, to ease the work of the horses, and we arrived at Carnoy, as I say, about 12 o'clock. We did the 20 miles in 5 hours and rested until about 2, and we were on standby. We weren't actually engaged in any work. We were on standby, but I anticipated that we would be called on later in the day, possibly, to go up and form a party, a stretcher bearer party, you see, for casualties after dark. So I decided to reconnaissance is never wasted. Good reconnaissance is never wasted, and I had a walk on my own down to Caterpillar Valley, which was the one of the main approaches to the line, up into the direction of High Wood. I was walking up there steadily, looking around, noting the condition of the track, seeing what was on either side, getting accustomed to the territory in case I had to go up there. And lo and behold, a tank came that we'd heard about in the morning. A tank came trundling down the track, and when it saw me alone, it stopped. Then the top opened, and the commander stuck his head out and said to me, "Oh, Sergeant," he said, "have you got a drink?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I've got a drink." I gave him my brandy flask. And there were two, he had two crew inside, and I noticed they were all wounded, you see. And then I looked at the side of the tank. It was a female tank. It had two Vickers machine guns, one on either flank. And I looked at the side of the tank, and I saw that it was perforated with holes all round close to the machine, where the machine gun barrel was. I counted about 20, and there were several more. And I looked through them into the tank and stuck my finger in one of the holes, gingerly. And the commander said to me, "Yes," he says, "you may well do that." He says, "they told us they were bulletproof." But of course, they were bulletproof against the ordinary rifle bullet. But the Germans had got wind of the tanks, obviously, and they'd produced an anti-tank rifle with an armour-piercing bullet, and this tank, in particular, had caught the full blast of either one or two anti-tank rifles. Later on in the war, I saw one, and the barrel was about 6 feet, 7 feet long, and of course the muzzle velocity of that bullet must have been enormous, and with an armour-piercing head, no wonder they went through the first tanks.
Did you treat the tank crew's wounds at all?
No, they were already dressed. I looked at them and saw that the dressings were adequate for the... They weren't severely wounded, they were only lightly wounded. But he told me when the bullets hit the wall of the tank, the inside wall of the tank, the metal flaked. He says, and the flakes were whirling around like razor blades inside the tank. I gave him the drink, wished him good luck, and he wished thank you very much. He thanked me, and then they passed on. And that was my first experience of the tanks.
What happened next, sir? Did you continue your reconnaissance?
I continued my reconnaissance up the road, got as far as close to High Wood, and I could see that there was going to be no difficulty in getting up that far. And I thought, well, I'd better get back, because I didn't want to be away too long from the field ambulance in case that I was needed, you see. But that was my experience of Tank Day, the 15th of September 1916.
Were you sent up that night on a...
No, we didn't go. It was a blank expedition for us. We never went into work, never treated a casualty, went back again.
Right, back out of the line.
Right back to Montreux again. Our next action was the November attack on Bowman Hamel on the Somme, at the top of the Somme. It was the last battle of the Somme, the last operation of the Somme battle. And we went up there all ready to go in if necessary. Cavalry went up too, all ready to go in. But again, the Germans, they held Beaumont Hamel until almost the last 2 days, and they lost it. But we didn't get sufficiently far beyond Beaumont Hamel to warrant any pursuit of any kind. And the Somme battle ended with that battle. The Somme battle itself ended.
And what happened to you during that battle? What role did your unit play?
None whatever. We just stood by, waiting to go in if required. We never went in. The second half of 1916 was a pretty blank year, so far as we were concerned, for work. Standing by, never going in.
Did you want to go into battle in these occasions? Were you keen to get involved?
Well, we were always it wasn't a question of wanting. We were always ready to go in, you see, but we just stood by ready. We were disappointed, of course, that we didn't go in, because it meant that the attacks had not turned out as well as expected. That was the disappointment. Disappointment that the unfortunate infantry attacks had not turned out as well as expected. There was a very good reason for the hard slogging of the Somme battle. When we got so far into the Somme that we could go down their trenches, the captured trenches, and have a look at their dugouts and their accommodation. It was no wonder that they were able to hold the line. I mean, they went 20 feet down below underground. They went down 20, 30 feet sometimes with almost living rooms underground, right well below the effects of shell fire. They were as clever as cats, there's no doubt about it. And hard working. They must have worked like beavers to create such a defensive position.
After the attack on Beaumont Hamel, did you go back again to your base?
Yes, back to the same base, Montechort.
Now, what was the next thing that happened then?
Well, the next thing that happened was Arras, April 1915.
So you stayed at Montechort right through?
We stayed at Montechort all the winter, getting our exercising our mounted pack section. Getting that, you know, getting going out and getting the horses accustomed to carrying the stretchers and that, and 1917, and nothing happened until the end of March. At the end of March, we marched up to Arras, and the Easter Monday battle, Easter Sunday battle, Easter Sunday. April the 8th, Easter Sunday, I think it was, or the 9th, we went up on the Saturday to Arras and through Arras, and we sweated under our packs. We had a pack for that particular job, our ordinary infantry pack, you see, and we went up there and we sweated under our packs. On the Sunday night, the temperature fell. And on the Monday, there were 20 degrees of frost, 20 degrees of frost on the Easter Monday, and then a snowfall. I've never seen the weather turn around like that. And, of course, the infantry went over, the troops went over, almost in a snowstorm, and they took about three or four miles of ground up to a place called Fampoux. Fampoux, Fampoux, which is on the crest of a hill, northeast of Arras. I remember that place very well because that was the limit of where we got to with the field ambulance. The ambulances got up into Fampoux. And I remember it because one day, many years later, only about 10 or 12 years before he died, I was talking to the late Lord Whig, and we were talking about weather, because we were sheltering from a very dirty day in England on Sandown Park Racecourse, and I was talking to him about the weather, and I said, this is the worst day I remember since Easter Monday 1917 at Fampoux. He says, were you at Fampoux? I said, yeah. He says, my brother was killed there. That was an extraordinary thing. My brother was killed there. And it changed hands. Fampoux changed hands about six times. That will give you an idea of the intensity of the battle. But the cavalry went in there. The cavalry went in, and division.
This is acting as infantry.
As cavalry. One division went in, attempted to act as cavalry, and of course were cut down. And they came back. They attempted to go in as cavalry in the mud and frost and so, but it just didn't happen. Of course, they weren't long on the horses. They were often acting as infantry until they were pulled. They were pulled out very quickly. Now, one night there, I must recall an incident. People talk about generals never going into the front line. On the Monday, Easter Monday night, I was going between Arras and Phampoo, and I came across our brigadier, Brigadier General Ernest Makins, afterwards Sir Ernest Makins, and the brother of Lord Sherfield, who was our ambassador to New York, Sir Ernest Makins, M-A-K-I-N-S. He and his staff officers, three of them, caught up with me, and I was stopping and taking shelter behind a dump of Mills bombs. There was a top heap of boxes, and I made a little cubby hole out of moving them so that I could get out of the wind for a half an hour, you see. And it was night, dead midnight. And they came up, and one of his staff officers said to me, he says, "Are you all right there, Sergeant?" I said, "Yes." I said, "It's out of the wind." He says, "Well," he says, "let the generals come and take your place for a bit." I said, "You look, sir." I said, "All these boxes are full of Mills bombs." I said, "If anything comes over," I said, "there'll be no general and neither me or anyone else." I said, "I should get a safer place if I were you." And I pointed down to some dugouts off the road. I said, "There's some old German dugouts there. You'll probably find a much better place for you to rest for a couple of hours." Now, that was General Sir Ernest Makins, who commanded the 1st Cavalry Brigade. And to his eternal credit, he kept the Cavalry Brigade out of that battle. They were there, but he kept them out of it. I think he made representations that the ground and the conditions were absolutely impossible, and he kept them out of it because they couldn't have survived in them.
So you again were just in reserve at Phampoo?
We were right in the battle line. We were right in the battle line there because Phampoo was the front line, just at the top of the hill, below where I was at the bottom of the rise, but the top of the hill was front line.
So who was in the front line?
Front line were would be infantry.
You were just there independently.
And our 1st Cavalry and our brigade, but dismounted. Not mounted. They never went in mounted. They went in dismounted, you see.
So what were conditions like at Phampoo? How was it compared?
It was drier up there because it was at the top of a rise, you see. But it was down in the valley, at the slope below Phampoo. That was a swamp. You know, after the snow and ice had gone, after 2 days of ice and snow, 3 days, about 2 or 3 days, then the sun came out and the thaw came, and what had been frozen became a swamp. And the only way they could get ammunition up to the guns was on the backs of pack horses, of mules. They had to have mules, one shell on either side of the mule, to get ammunition up to the guns.
So how would you set up your... were you again in charge of the forward aid post?
Post, yeah. Never did a casualty. I never did a casualty. But the ambulance was split into two parts. There was one part up in Phampoo, and I was just to the right of it. The one in Phampoo got casualties and had a medical officer, Captain Thomas. He was wounded with a bullet in the leg. Now, I heard later that he had died from that wound because from gangrene, because, you see, the frost had got into the wound. I heard later that he had died from it.
So, were you actually going forward? Did you have forward stretcher posts and as before? Was your routine...
No, we were all in one group. We were all in one group.
So how was it organised? Could you...
Well, we're organised and waiting orders, you see.
You weren't going up to the trenches to bring back people?
No, we were there. We were ordered to stay put there and wait orders.
So any casualties that came back were brought back by the regiments in front?
No, the casualties were brought up by the other section of the field ambulance, you see. The other part of the... They were up in Phampoo itself. They caught all the casualties, but not my section.
How long were you there, and what dates? Huh? What dates were you there from?
Well, we were there from the Saturday. Saturday that would be April the 7th. April the 7th. I think Sunday was April the 8th, and Monday April the 9th. We were there what? 8 days, about 8 days, and then we were pulled out.
Had trench life or frontline life changed much, in your opinion? Was there anything you noticed that was different?
There were no trenches there, you see, because the German front line had been crossed, and the only trenches there were German trenches, and we were in the out in the open. No trenches at all.
You didn't use the German ones?
No, didn't use the German ones, no.
Was there any reason for that?
Well, no, there was no they were probably full of clogged up with water, you know, or wet, and maybe full of fleas, because I noticed on the side of the door between Fampu and Alice there was a notice, Entlausung, Entlausung. Now that is that's German for delousing station. And I knew then that the Germans were as lousy as we were.
You'd lost your lice.
We lost our lice, but the Germans had still got them. We'd lost ours in number one, but the Germans had still got them. So that was the Entlausung, the delousing station.
Were there anything you noticed had changed about the character of life near the front line? Any new developments that had come along?
No, the only thing is that we heard that the infantry had started to move under what was known as a creeping barrage, and that saved a lot of casualties. You know, the barrage was timed in steps, and providing they kept close to the barrage, they could get to the Germans before they had time to get to their machine guns. That was the first intimation we ever heard of the words creeping barrage.
Now, earlier you mentioned that there had been a new thing in the medical side, and that the Thomas Splint had come out in 1917. Had that arrived by then?
Yes, that had just arrived. And after the battle of Arras, I went to a demonstration by a colonel of the Royal Army Medical Corps to a demonstration of this splint called the Thomas Splint. It was a round hoop, padded hoop at the top, and down in parallel lines was a thin iron rail, and at the bottom it turned over became a loop through which a bandage could be passed, and there was a second piece which fitted onto the instep of a soldier's boot. Now, when you pass the bandage between the loop on the splint and this small foot attachment, you were able to get what we call counter extension, that is, separation of the bones of the fracture, so that the edges are not rubbing against one another. Now, that was one of the things which I got top for in before the war.
You mentioned
And this demonstration was most interesting to me because I watched the colonel do it, and I could see that you could easily get an inch to an inch and a half of counter extension on that limb. You see, by pulling it in reverse ways and then tying an ordinary bandage would be sufficient to do the tying job. And he told us that before this splint was invented, 70% of all casualties involving compound fractures of the femur, that's the thigh bone, were fatal. And since this splint had been used in a test area, they tested it out, and it had reduced the fatalities to 30%, which was a godsend, of course, to the infantry and the wounded infantrymen with a compound fracture of the thigh.
Were there any other new developments that you found in medicine or medical treatments at that time that you were made aware of?
Well, yes, there were, but we didn't come into contact very much with them. The iodine, which had been the good old standby for treating all wounds, you know, the first thing you did was to do the edges of a wound with iodine, or if it was not very large, you could paint iodine over the whole surface. But someone invented a substance called Eusol, and Eusol, and Eusol, and that because it, you see, iodine was caused a bit shock. It burnt. You know, you put iodine on a cut, and it's like a burn, because what iodine does is to burn.